Hello everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries, and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me. As always, thank you so much for the support on the podcast. I was just checking our analytics for the podcast, and actually turns out that we have listeners from pretty much all over the world now. We have listeners from the UK, the US, Greece, Canada, Australia, Korea, Portugal, Italy, Russia, and Germany.
That's really impressive, Josh, but what's even more impressive is the fact that you managed to say analytical.
I know, analytics.
Or analytics, whatever it was, yeah. Please follow, share with your friends, and write us a review, but only if it's a good one.
Also, please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Murder, Mother and Me Podcast, where we post all of the pictures and more information about the subject of our episodes.
Today we're enjoying coffee and cake from Starbucks. It's a Starbucks special. We've got some lemon drizzle cake.
It's a little bit basic, but Starbucks was the only thing open.
I liked it.
This week we are talking about a story that takes place in 2003. Here are a few interesting facts about that year.
The space shuttle Columbia disintegrated during re-entry into Earth's atmosphere, killing the crew of STS-107. The final episode of Liverpool-based soap opera Brookside aired after 21 years. One of the most popular songs of 2003 was 50 Cent in Da Club.
Why'd you have to say it like that?
I don't know, it's just got a kind of Jamaican kind of feel to it to me.
Say it again.
In Da Club. Stop it now.
Right everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. This is the story of the death of Brian Wells and the pizza bomber heist. On August 28th, 2003, a pizza delivery man named Brian Wells walked into a bank with a live bomb strapped around his neck. He had a cane in one hand that doubled as a shotgun, and he handed the teller a note demanding $250,000. But in less than 1 hour, Brian would be dead, the bomb around his neck detonating as police watched in horror. Who was Brian Wells? How did he end up involved in such a twisted scheme? Today, we'll unravel the tangled web of characters and motivations behind the heist that left a quiet town shaken and a family searching for answers. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Brian Douglas Wells was born on 15th of November 1956 in Erie, Pennsylvania, and was one of six children. Before this tragic day, Brian's story was relatively unremarkable. He was well known around Erie, and friends and family described him as quiet, kind-hearted, and non-confrontational. He lived alone and had worked as a pizza delivery driver for over 20 years in Erie, and had spent the last decade working for Mamma Mia's Pizzeria. He didn't seem to have any particular ambitions beyond a simple life. Brian was considered an unlikely candidate for involvement in any crime, let alone an elaborate heist. But on that day, he became a pawn in a sick and twisted plot.
Sounds interesting.
It is very interesting, and let's not just skim over the fact that we're talking about another Brian again.
Oh, of course we are. I think this is our third Brian to date, isn't it?
I don't think it's good luck if your name's Brian at this point.
Don't name your kids Brian.
On the early afternoon of 28th of August 2003 in Erie, Pennsylvania, 46-year-old Brian received an order at Mamma Mia's Pizzeria to deliver two pizzas to an address he didn't recognise, an isolated radio transmission tower on the outskirts of town. According to the police report, Brian drove to the secluded location around 1:30 p.m. There, he was reportedly ambushed by a group of people who forced a heavy, homemade bomb collar around his neck. They handed him a series of detailed instructions, threatening that if he did not follow each step precisely, the bomb would detonate. The first instruction was that Brian had to rob a PNC bank in Erie. I mean, surely the fact that this is a pizza being delivered to a radio transmission tower should ring alarm bells.
I didn't think so. I mean, there's people that work there, so why would they not fancy a pizza? Maybe late on at night or something, I don't know. I wonder what they ordered. Was it like a...
I was just going to say, I know you're thinking, what kind of pizza did they order?
What's those sausage, little sausage bits
called? Pepperoni.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's a pepperoni. Don't ask me why.
I have a feeling it would have been something a bit outrageous, like ham and pineapple.
I was going to say chicken and pineapple. Something with a pineapple anyway. Maybe pepperoni and pineapple. Couldn't get weirder than that, could you?
At 2:20 p.m., Brian entered the PNC Bank. Surveillance footage shows him calm but moving with a purpose, a bulging device locked to his neck. In his hand was a cane, later identified as a modified shotgun, and a note demanding $250,000. Despite the high amount demanded, the teller could only provide $8,702. Brian took the cash and left without argument, heading back to his car in the bank parking lot, but the clock was ticking. Brian had only minutes left before the bomb would detonate.
Can I just say now, I mean, what kind of bank is that? He's asking for $250,000 and they give him $8,000 and whatever it was.
They've shortchanged him a bit there, haven't they? God.
I mean, you know, what's going to happen now? He's not even got the correct money.
Well, also as well, it doesn't sound like he's really raised any alarms in the bank, even though when you watch this surveillance footage, you can clearly see that there's something underneath his t-shirt, like at the top of his chest. It's like, when it says bulging, it really means bulging. Like, it's like he's got something tucked underneath his t-shirt, so...
Well, he did have something tucked underneath his t-shirt.
Obviously, they didn't know that he had a bomb around his neck, but...
Well, maybe they thought he was at some kind of, like, you know, surgical neck brace on or something.
Yeah, I don't know, but it would have definitely set off red flags in my mind, 100%. Also, this cane that he had, it actually didn't look anything like a gun, to be fair. It just looked like an old man's, like, walking stick, like a cane. So I don't think that would raise any red flags.
No, I bet he thought he'd been in an accident or something and was coming in with his cane and his thing for his neck. I don't know. Maybe they just, you know, assumed something like that. He seems really calm, doesn't he, for someone going in to rob a bank, despite the fact that, obviously, he's been forced into it. He's not, as you say, you know, standing out, really, apart from the way he was, you know, with this collar on and everything.
No, I think even from when you watch the CCTV footage, he just walks in and he waits in line as well. There's a queue of customers before he gets to the bank teller, so he actually just stands in the queue like a normal person and waits for his turn. He doesn't, like, push to the front and start shouting or anything. And a lot of eyewitnesses just said how calm he actually looked. It was a bit eerie,
Probably. That was a good joke, that, Josh. I think he was probably in shock, maybe a little bit, so...
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of this will come into question a bit later on in the story. Just down the road, police spotted Brian's car and pulled him over, where he was taken out and handcuffed. For a 10 to 25 minutes, Brian pleaded with the officers, repeating over and over that he'd been forced into this, that he didn't want to be there, and that he was just a delivery man. He said, "I'm not lying. It's going to go off. I'm not lying. Please get this off me."
I'm really feeling sorry for Brian.
I mean, it sounds now like he's a bit less calm and like he's panicking.
He wasted a bit of time in that queue, though, didn't he? He had his gun. He could have gone straight to the front. Why didn't he do that? Brian, think,
and
man.
Also, what I'm confused about is, it says the police just took him out of his car and handcuffed him, but can they not see this big thing around his neck? And he's obviously telling them, "There's something around my neck. It's going to blow. It's going to go off." But for them to get up close and personal with him, drag him out of the car and handcuff him, that's not a bit risky? As police waited for the bomb squad, who were still minutes away, Brian grew increasingly agitated. There's footage of this harrowing moment. He's sitting on the ground, handcuffed, glancing down at the device strapped around his neck, shaking his head, pleading for help. He tells the officers that he was just delivering a pizza when he was jumped and had this device locked onto him. But the officers, skeptical of his story, held back. I'm still a bit confused why initially they just dragged him out of the car. Maybe they didn't believe him. They thought he was a bit crazy or something.
Maybe they didn't realise that. I mean, he's just held up a bank. They've had an alarm raised about that, but they've seen him and just grabbed him, but then they realise there's something wrong, and that's when they start to isolate him. But I've actually seen this footage as well, a long time ago it was, and it's awful.
I mean, they are just, like, surrounding him in the middle of a road, and he's just sat in the middle of the street.
He's leaning against the car wheel, yeah. I think, or something, isn't he, just with his back there. And I think it was a case of, if he moved and tried to run, and he can't run away from it because it's strapped around his neck, but... he's got nowhere to go, has he? Because it's still on him. And they would have shot him, probably, which might have been best, really.
Well, I think also, just going back to what I said about the surveillance footage in the bank, you can see this big thing protruding out of his neck. So that's what's confusing me about why they initially just dragged him out, because it doesn't look natural.
Was it, I mean, what was it that was around his neck? Was it just like a big iron collar?
Imagine like a... It looks almost a bit like, you know, one of those massive bear traps with the big teeth. Imagine that kind of thickness of, like, iron, and it's like a collar that they just clipped around his neck.
And it was bolted shut or something?
It was, well, whatever it was, it wasn't coming off. At 3:18 p.m., the bomb began to beep. Seconds later, it exploded, killing Brian Wells instantly. Officers and spectators watched in horror, unsure of what had just happened. One of the officers later described, "It was like watching an awful magic trick. One moment he was there, pleading for help, and the next, he was gone." Brian Wells' death was horrifying, and no one seemed to understand how or why this had happened. Was he a victim or a conspirator? Who would set up such a sadistic plan, and why? So just touching on that as well, when the bomb actually exploded, it said that the impact of the bomb caused a fist-sized hole through his chest, and it killed him instantly. So he literally was there 1 minute and gone the next.
But, without being too graphic, I would have thought it'd blow his head off, to be honest.
Well, no, it didn't. It must have...
You actually see this on the footage. You see the explosion, but I didn't look at it, so I don't know what happened.
Yeah, you see the explosion, but it doesn't... You just see like a pop and a bang. It's not like a big, like you would imagine, like a bomb explosion.
Like a shotgun or something.
Yeah, and I think the blast of the impact just went literally directly through his chest. This wasn't a small device around his neck. It was pretty big. And also just a little bit of a extra gruesome detail is... Because the police needed to take the collar off his neck to examine and fingerprints and stuff, they actually had to decapitate Brian. So they had to remove his head in order to get the collar off because they actually couldn't get the collar off
Their
own means.
Isn't that awful?
It's horrendous.
That poor man, though.
And this video is on the internet somewhere still for everyone to see. There were news cameras there. There were people with phones. There was all kinds.
The thing is, the alarming thing about it is they didn't really try to help him, did they? They called for the bomb squad. I don't know how long they had from when the bomb squad arrived, you know, but they didn't really do anything. They just all looked at him, didn't they, and watched this happen.
Well, it said he was pleading for 25 minutes when he was sat there. And I guess, you know, just playing devil's advocate as always, you've got to see it from the police's perspective. It's too much of a hazard for them to go in and try and remove that collar. And for all they know, it might be a fake. They don't know that it's a real bomb.
So did they not know that there was 25 minutes left? Did they think it could have gone off like in 2 minutes so they wouldn't approach
him? No one knew when it was going to go off, not even Brian.
So he sat there for 25 minutes waiting for someone to help him?
Yeah, and by the time they got there, it was too late. In the immediate aftermath, the FBI took over the investigation, along with the Pennsylvania State Police. They discovered a set of handwritten instructions in Wells' car, which can only be described as a scavenger hunt, listing a series of strictly timed tasks of collecting keys that would delay detonation and eventually defuse the bomb. The pages warned that Brian would be under constant surveillance and any attempts to contact authorities would result in the bomb's detonation. "Act now, think later, or you will die," was scrawled at the bottom of the instructions. So it's almost like whoever this was, they were playing some kind of weird game with him as well.
Where were those?
They were found in Brian's car.
So they'd given him those instructions?
I assume when they strapped the bomb around his neck, they gave him these instructions. And it was almost a bit like a game. Like, if you can get here in X amount of time, you'll gain an extra minute or whatever of time of the bomb not detonating. And then, you know, then from there, you need to get to the next place. And that will add an extra however long on.
They've thought a lot about this, haven't they, about the way they wanted to do it.
It's very well thought out.
But for him, you know, to try and complete these tasks under pressure, did he complete any of these tasks before he went to rob the bank? Was robbing the bank number one?
I think robbing the bank was the first instruction on the list. Another part of the note read, "Proceed to exit the bank with the money and follow these directions precisely. There will be a series of notes, each leading to the next, that you must find to get the keys to unlock your collar. Follow every direction exactly." This scavenger hunt led to multiple locations around Erie, each clue apparently leading to the next step in a sequence. But there was no way of knowing if the clues would have even led to a defusal key, or if Brian was always doomed from the start. Though the note claimed Brian would gain extra time by each key found, police later travelled the note's exact route and could not complete it in the allocated time, implying Brian would not have had enough time to get the bomb defused regardless.
Poor Brian.
So the game that they've actually set up is not a game you can win.
He was going to die all along, wasn't he?
That bomb was going to detonate whether he found however many keys that were hidden or not.
What a horrible thing to do to someone.
Which is horrendous because you're kind of given false hope as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
He might think that's a way out.
I don't really know what the point of all that is, though. He's robbed the bank, so why take him on this scavenger hunt to find these keys to unlock it if he's never going to have time to do it?
I'm going to tell you now that that is a question that still no one knows the answer to.
Do you know what it's like? It's a bit like an escape room, isn't it? If you solve the thing, you get out and you're under pressure. And we all went once, right, to do this escape room, and I was absolutely rubbish, right? I'd have blown up in 2 minutes, let me tell you.
Yeah, because people don't perform well under pressure.
Some people do.
Some people do.
If your life's on the line, I suppose you think you would perform better, but I think it can sometimes have the opposite effect.
Well, it also leads to irrational things, doesn't it, when you're under pressure? And especially if your life's on the line, you probably start doing things that you would never even consider doing, like robbing a bank.
Imagine reading those instructions, and I'd just have, like, word blindness. I would not be able to take it in.
And I think, you know,
I can't even read this on the screen.
Yeah. And they've put these clues in there to probably make him think, like, actually, if I do go through these set of instructions and I complete the tasks, there is a chance that I'll leave with my life.
It's like they were toying with him, isn't it? You know, and watching him do this, as you say, with no hope of actually being alive at the end of it. That's cruel, isn't it?
It's very cruel, very evil. Investigators headed to the address where Brian had allegedly been ambushed, the radio tower site. And there, they found tire tracks and evidence that seemed to suggest a struggle had taken place. But even with these discoveries, the mystery only deepened. The investigation took a bizarre turn when three unlikely figures emerged as potential suspects. Marjorie Deal Armstrong, Kenneth Barnes, and William Rothstein. Marjorie was known in Erie as eccentric, brilliant, and deeply troubled. She had a history of suffering from multiple mental illnesses, including bipolar disorder. Before her mental health deteriorated in her 20s, she was an exemplary student in high school and earned a master's degree from Gannon College. In 1984, she killed her boyfriend Robert Thomas by shooting him 6 times as he lay on the couch. She was subsequently acquitted of murder, claiming it was self-defense. Her future husband and several other partners also died under suspicious circumstances.
Now that's just a bit of a red flag, isn't it? Marjorie's taking down everyone.
Exactly, and it only gets weirder from there.
There was a Marjorie who lived 2 doors away from us, you know. She was married to Colin.
Did she shoot him 6 times on the couch?
No, but he did die unexpectedly.
Did he really?
Yeah, but he had a heart attack. But He was up a tree in the back, like Indiana Jones. We called him Indiana Col, cutting branches off the tree. But I'm just saying, you know, Marjorie also was a bit, you know, you wouldn't meddle with Marjorie.
Not much is known about Kenneth Barnes. He was from Erie and was a retired television repairman, crack dealer, and Marjorie Deal Armstrong's fishing buddy. How do you repair tallies and deal crack at the same time?
Maybe it was like a bog-off, buy one, get one free.
That's three really random things to be involved in, isn't it? Television repairs, dealing crack, and going fishing.
Well, you know, it's got fishing buddy in inverted commas. What does that exactly mean, fishing buddy?
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's like a Joey from Friends situation where he does the inverted commas for no reason.
I love that. Or maybe fishing buddy means something else.
Well, as we'll learn, it sounds like Marjorie was a bit of a madam, so could be that he was one of her flings on the side, who knows. Mm. William Rothstein, known as Bill, dated Marjorie in the late 1960s and early 1970s. He was implicated in a 1977 murder after he gave a handgun to a friend who used it to murder a romantic rival. He later attempted to destroy the weapon but was granted immunity from prosecution. Bill was a handyman and a part-time shop teacher and was part of a group called the Fractured Intellectuals, a group of intelligent people who were not well adjusted. It is believed that Bill was the creator of the homemade collar bomb.
So Bill has also been in a relationship with Marjorie?
Well, yeah, we don't actually know that our friend Ken was in a relationship with her, but we know that he was a fishing buddy, in inverted commas.
Right. It's like a bit of a love triangle.
But the main anchor of this whole story, as we'll realise very quickly, is Marjorie.
Marjorie, yeah.
And everyone that's involved,
Marjorie's the mastermind,
is linked to her in some way, whether that's through a relationship or friends or going fishing or whatever it may be.
Just from listening to that bit, it's like Marjorie's got control over all of these people.
Well, and also, you know, they're all involved in crime in some way, shape or form. She's killed previous partners. Bill here has been involved in a murder or supplying a weapon for a murder, and Ken is a craft dealer. So they're all involved in some kind of criminal activity.
Illegal activities.
Illegal activity, exactly.
What did Marjorie look like? I imagine it's sort of like Miriam Margolyes, whatever her name is. Is that her name?
I'm going to pull a picture up so we can look at her. So I've just pulled a picture up of Marjorie.
Oh, God.
And safe to say, she is...
She looks like Herman Munster, to be honest.
Yeah, she is not blessed with the looks. I mean, I'm looking at a picture of her from her youth as well, and she didn't look like a bad-looking woman, to be honest.
Yeah, she wasn't bad.
She's given me, like, Gollum from Lord of the Rings vibes. with a wig on. Can you see that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, in some of the articles that I've read as well, it says that they feel like the main two involved were Marjorie and actually Bill, because they think that he was, or they know that he was actually a very intelligent man, and he is believed to have constructed this homemade bomb that they strapped around Brian's neck.
Well, it says he was a handyman.
Yeah.
And also he was intelligent, wasn't he? So he probably could have figured something out.
They believe that this whole scavenger hunt was concocted by him as well.
I think it sounds more like that's something like Marjorie would do, to be honest, but I don't know.
Marjorie had a dark past, and according to acquaintances, she was desperate to come into money quickly. Investigators uncovered a possible motive. She allegedly wanted the funds to hire a hitman to kill her own father, whom she accused of mismanaging her inheritance. She suggested Ken kill her father, Harold Deal, so she would receive an inheritance. Ken told her he was willing to do this for $250,000, which, you know, ironically is the amount that Brian was asking for in the bank. The Collarbomb bank robbery plot was hatched to obtain enough money to pay Ken to kill Marjorie's father.
So she was going to kill somebody else?
Well, this whole thing seems... killed. Yeah, this whole thing seems like it's a plan within a plan.
Yeah.
You know, they needed the money to be able to pay Ken to kill her dad. So it all started from that, really, from her wanting money. So it's a thing of greed again, as we see time and time again with people. The police managed to turn Ken Barnes as an informant, and in exchange for leniency, he revealed what he claimed was the whole story. According to Ken, Marjorie was indeed the mastermind behind the plot, enlisting several local associates to help with the scheme, including Bill Rothstein, who actually lived near the radio tower where the pizzas were ordered to.
Do you know what I read that as then? Honestly, this is what I read. Enlisting several local assholes to help with the scheme.
Well, that as well, yeah. On September 20th, 2003, almost 1 month after Brian Wells' death, Bill Rothstein, who lived near the television tower, called police to inform them the body of a man, James Roden, was hidden in a freezer in a garage at his house.
So is this somebody else that's dead now?
I'm about to tell you.
Go on.
James had been living with Marjorie for 10 years.
Of course it was Marjorie.
In custody, Bill claimed Marjorie had murdered her then-boyfriend, James Roden, with a 12-gauge shotgun during a dispute over money. Bill said she subsequently paid him $2,000 to help him hide the body and clean the crime scene at her house. She sounds like a right one, this Marjorie, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And it always involves a partner or a spouse or something.
Yeah. You don't want to be, like, making friends with Marjorie, do you?
Certainly not.
Poor James Roden. Poor James Roden. Oh, my God. I can see him as a giant rat now. I'm sorry, James. Knew this was going to happen today.
So this is actually just, you know, this crime is... It's not even relevant to this story. It's relevant to the story, but it's not relevant to the part that Brian Wells played in this story. This is just a complete other different crime.
Yeah, they're all like offshoots, aren't they? All things going on in the background, aren't they?
But it plays a part into kind of learning a little bit more into Marjorie and how horrendous she is, basically. One of the biggest questions in this case is Brian Wells' level of involvement. Was he an unwilling victim, or had he agreed to play a role in the heist? Investigators found some evidence that Wells may have had prior knowledge or even some connection to the suspects. He had apparently known some of the people involved, either casually or as part of the local social circles in Erie. In fact, a co-worker would later testify that Brian seemed to know Rothstein, one of the key suspects from around town. According to some theories, Brian may have believed that the bomb was fake, a scare tactic to get him out of a financial bind, only to realise too late that he had been misled. Regardless of his intentions, what's clear is that the heist was planned in minute detail, every piece of it carefully constructed to play out like a twisted game. Now, this is one of the biggest things, because on both sides of the story, you've got people that say he was involved, people that say that he definitely wasn't involved.
Is it like a 50-50 kind of situation, that all?
Well, it's a 50-50, because no one actually knows. So... people are saying, yeah, I know he was involved because of XYZ, and then other people are saying he wasn't involved because of XYZ as well.
I suppose it depends on how well he knew the people involved. The same casually, you know, socially out and about around town, but he might, if he's got financial difficulties, he may have thought he could trust them and it was all a big setup. And it sounds believable if someone said.
I think it is believable. I think if they said to him, go on, just put this thing around your neck, it's not a real bomb, it's going to look like a, it's going to look like a real bomb, but it's fake. All you have to do is just get us that cash and we'll pay you however much and you're kind of free financially.
It's still a bit risky though, isn't it? I mean, he's robbing a bank, isn't he? Could have very well been caught as he was. But I think Brian sounds not too bright. I'm sorry, Brian, but these people he's dealing with are all intellectual people here, or the other people involved in the plot are intellectual people. Brian just seems like an everyday guy. He's been in the pizza delivery business for 20 years. Doesn't seem like he had much aspirations to climb up a, you know, a ladder of a career ladder or anything. So, you know, I'm not saying he was stupid, but he might have just been a bit gullible and just an everyday fella, you know.
And I think with, you know, Marjorie, Bill and Ken being quite intelligent, they probably knew that the likelihood of him going into that bank and robbing it and getting out without being arrested is not very high. So I think they knew that he was going to get arrested and they knew he was going to die the whole time.
I think so
and
too.
And whether he knew the bomb was fake or real, I can't really get it out of my mind watching that video of him sat in the street and he's pleading for his life. He's not just like, if you know it's fake, you're not going to plead like that, because regardless, even if they figure out it's a fake and they get it off you, you're still getting arrested.
Yeah, I think unless it just dawned on him at that point that it probably was real.
Well, it said the bomb started beeping, and I think maybe that's kind of triggered something in his head and thought, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah, it might have only been at that moment that he realised, which is explain why he walked into the bank so calmly.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I was saying. If he knew it was fake, he had no reason to be stressed. He had no reason to panic in that bank. He would wait in the queue. Going back to what you said earlier, like, he wasted a lot of time standing in that queue. But why would you do that?
You wouldn't, would you? That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. You go straight to the front because you think, I'm not going to waste minutes.
Exactly.
So that points to the fact that he probably did think it wasn't
fake.
A real bomb. Yeah.
In January 2005, Marjorie Deal Armstrong pleaded guilty but mentally ill to third-degree murder and abuse of a corpse for the killing of James Roden and was sentenced to between 7 and 20 years in prison. She is believed to have killed James to prevent him from informing authorities about the robbery plot. So this was just for the killing of her boyfriend, James Roden, in the freezer.
I'm just thinking, you know, I wonder if James Roden may have been the initial person they were going to put the bomb on.
Possibly. But maybe they needed someone, like you said, that was a little bit more gullible.
Yeah. I mean, it was just a thought, you know.
And not as connected. 3 years later, on July 29th, 2008, US District Court Judge Sean J. McLaughlin made an initial finding that Marjorie was mentally incompetent to stand trial due to a number of mental disorders, indicating this ruling would be reviewed after she had received a period of treatment in a mental hospital. In October 2010, she was considered competent to stand trial and took the stand in her own defence. Of course she did, just like every other psychopath, pathological liar.
Narcissistic, sociopath, yeah. Like Ted Bundy did that, didn't he, you know? Well, he was training to be a lawyer, Ted Bundy.
They all do it.
That's another case, but and thought it was best to represent himself, which was the worst thing he could have done.
On November 1st, 2010, Marjorie Deal Armstrong was convicted of armed bank robbery, conspiracy to commit armed bank robbery, and of using a destructive device in a crime. On February 28th, 2011, she was sentenced to life in prison to be served consecutively with the prison term imposed in 2005 for killing James Roden. Kenneth Barnes, who cooperated with authorities, received a reduced sentence of 45 years in exchange for his testimony, which cemented Marjorie's role as the ringleader. But even with these convictions, many felt that the full truth never emerged. William Bill Rothstein died of cancer on July the 30th, 2004, at the age of 60, and was classed as an unindicted co-conspirator in the pizza bomber case, because obviously he was no longer alive to be able to stand trial with the rest of them. And also, weirdly, they also class Brian Wells as an unindicted co-conspirator as well.
Isn't that sad?
That was the official ruling.
Isn't that sad, though, because not only was he blown up with this bomb, he's now getting blamed partly for it, for, you know, his own involvement, which might or might not be true, but he's not even here to defend himself, is he?
In 2018, Jessica Hoopsick, a friend of Brian Wells, admitted to her involvement in the plot.
So this is someone else now?
This is another character in the story. Melissa Chan of Time wrote, Hoopsick says a conspirator approached her to find a gopher who could be scared into robbing the bank. I'm guessing a gopher is like someone that's easily persuaded, gullible.
Yeah, which was Brian.
Might just be a slang word. In the 2018 Netflix documentary Evil Genius, Hoopsick identifies the conspirator as Kenneth Barnes and alleges he recommended Wells, whom he described as a pushover. So they've obviously been looking for someone to strap that bomb onto. And he said to her, because you're his friend, can you convince him to come and do this for us?
Yeah, she's probably said to him, listen, you can make a lot of money doing this and it's not going to be real. And it points more to that now. I think he's actually, that was what actually happened, that he didn't think it was real. And then just from what we've already said about him not being stressed in the bank. And then I think when that bomber started beeping like it was going to detonate, that's when he realised, I think.
Well, it also says here, admitting to setting up Wells in exchange for money and drugs, Hoopsick expressed regret for her role and said Wells had no advanced knowledge of the robbery. So again, that's what I'm saying. There's some people saying that he was involved and there's some people saying that he had no knowledge of it.
So in this situation, what she's saying is it could very easily have been that she just pointed Brian out as someone who could be sort of like easily overpowered and would go along with everything. And, you know, a scenario of order a pizza to get him to the actual building, and they all just kind of jumped on him and put the collar on him, and he didn't have any prior knowledge of it at all.
Which is what the initial story leads you to believe. That's what the story is, essentially. However, on the flip side of that, it could be that she said to him, listen, would you be willing to do this? It's going to be a fake bomb. You just need to put it around your neck. You need to go into this bank and we'll pay you X, Y, Z. And, you know, she's obviously done this, like she said, in exchange for money and drugs. So he might have then been, yeah, okay, cool, let's do that. Sounds good.
No, I don't think so. Now I'm thinking that they just overpowered him, because didn't the police say there was like scuffle marks and things, or tire tracks?
Well, it just said that it said there was tire tracks and it said the scene looked like there'd been some kind of struggle.
It sounds...
But that can easily be staged.
I think now, just from in light of this, that I don't think he knew anything about it, really.
Yeah, it seems to me it sounds like this has been one big setup for him and he had no clue.
I don't think he knew. And I think also maybe when they did overpower him and put the collar on, they may have even said to him, listen, it's not real, but you've got to do this. And he's actually not thought it was real, but so just tried to carry out what they said until that bomb started beeping.
Well, I think also, you know, Brian's family have always been of the opinion that he would never have been involved in something like that knowingly.
It just sounds too ordinary to me, just like, just wanted to do his job and
yeah, didn't
home.
Want any drama, just wanted to plod along in life. And some people are happy to do that, aren't they? So yeah. I think, you know, this, I actually don't know how Jessica Hoopsick knew him, but it just said she was a friend of his. So it could just be, you know, an acquaintance, or it could be someone that he just knew from around town.
Could have been someone who ordered like 3 pizzas a week.
Exactly. And she, like you said, she's obviously just said to them, you need to go for this guy because he will kind of play along.
Isn't that awful?
And they've lured him out to this place, they've jumped him, strapped his thing around his neck, and next thing you know, he's dead. So many questions remain unanswered. Could Brian Wells have been saved? Was he a willing accomplice or just another victim? And what drove Marjorie and her conspirators to believe that they could get away with such a convoluted, deadly scheme? As always, you know, we love these cases where there are no answers, but at the same time, it's frustrating because I want to know if he was actually involved now.
You know, I think they should strap a big collar around Marjorie until she owns up with what actually happened.
I think the sad thing in this case, and we've said this about lots of the mysterious death kind of cases, is that we will never know the answers because Marjorie and Kenneth have both died in prison. Fairly recently, actually. I think Marjorie died in 2017 and Ken died in 2019, so...
So they didn't serve very long either, did they?
No, they served about 6 years, 7 years each, something like that. And those answers have gone to the grave with them, unfortunately.
So we're never going to know. And poor Brian's dead, so all the people with the answers have all gone. If we can just go back for a minute to when Brian got blown up by the bomb, and there was another indignity straight afterwards, which was the fact that they had to cut his head off, remove his head to get this collar off. I don't think that collar was ever going to come off. If that's what it took to get it off him, and they've got all kinds of experts, you know, in law enforcement trying to sort it out afterwards. I don't think that was ever going to come off. I don't believe there was a key.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that they would have tried other options before that. You know, like a circular saw or something to try and get it off, but...
Well, they must have all kinds of experts, and if they can't figure out how to open this collar, I don't think Brian ever had a chance of opening the collar.
Yeah, I don't think it was ever made to be opened, and that's the problem.
That's
so
what
I think he ever stood a chance. They set him up for failure right from the get-go, it seems.
It was just outright murder, wasn't it?
For Brian's family, there's no real closure, only pain and questions that will never be fully answered. This case reminds us that sometimes the truth is messier, stranger, and more tragic than fiction. Right then, so how do you feel about that one?
Well, it's a really bizarre story, isn't it?
It is a very bizarre story.
I mean, imagine ordering a pizza. Imagine if you were a pizza delivery man. You know, you wake for Domino's and then you got on your little Deliveroo bike and went along and you get to a house and someone straps that onto you.
What would you actually do, though?
What could you do?
I guess you'd just have to do what Brian did and go along with it. And hope that if you do follow the steps that they're telling you to follow, that you might survive. If you've got a bomb strapped around your neck, you're going to do whatever you can to get it off, aren't you?
Well, you're going to assume that it's real, I will think. That's what I'd do. I wouldn't 100%. Take any chances, you know. He definitely, I don't think, put it on willingly now as I've heard the whole story.
What a bizarre story.
Yeah, it was different, wasn't it? It wasn't your run-of-the-mill murder, was it?
No, and I think the amount of effort and planning that they went through to concoct this whole scavenger hunt, even just to make a homemade bomb out of a collar and strap it around someone's neck, even that alone is such a bizarre way to go about it.
How do you even make a homemade bomb though? I mean, do you just order stuff off the internet and then go in your kitchen and
can't say I'm an expert in homemade bomb making.
Glad to hear it. Right everyone, that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time,
don't do the crime.